We are so delighted to have a returning guest, someone very close to our hearts and to the hearts of many, many people in Philadelphia, Peter Nero. Welcome to Crossover.
Thank you, Jill. It's always a pleasure to be with one of my favorite people, you.
Thank you. You know, it's Peter is such an artist, I mean, in his own right. And I keep saying I remember him when, but I remember when he was on his own and he was so thrilling and so very successful. And, of course, I think people in Philadelphia think of you as the Philly Pops, Peter Nero and the Philly Pops. So tell us a little bit about the changeover. Peter, when did you actually decide, or did you kind of evolve into music director and this whole entity when you came here to Philadelphia?
That would go back to, I would say, the early 70s.
That long ago.
That long ago. I had been recording for about 10 years, and you know, Pops and symphony orchestras was relatively new. Boston Pops had been very well established. Mm-hmm. Do you know what year the Boston Pops was formed?
Oh, I read it somewhere. It's very old. Surprisingly.
The Boston Symphony was formed 20 years before the Philadelphia Orchestra, which would put it at 1880. And the Boston Pops was born from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. In 1885.
Oh, my.
So then last year was their 125th anniversary.
My goodness. Well, you're nowhere near that with the Philly Pops, but certainly what happened?
We're trying to catch up.
What happened when you, I mean, you had a career. You were the one that really, I mean, it was a tremendous career, too, and you were very, very popular. You were really something unique on the scene, too, because you were a pianist who played classical music, but then you played pop and you played jazz, and yet you were a tremendous figure that was loved by many types of audiences, and that was when you were solo.
Well, there is no niche for me to fit into, which was always a marketing problem. My albums wound up in, back then, what I was doing was considered pop, just like Frank Sinatra was pop,
right.
Tony Bennett was pop.
Right.
And then when the Beatles came in 1964, that changed everything.
Right.
And it then became, instead of doing the old standards, we would had to do the new material that came along.
Right.
So that was a big change. But when I did two albums with Fiedler and the Boston Pops back in 63 and 65. In 63, I did the Rhapsody in Blue plus six arrangements of Gershwin tunes. So it was an old Gershwin album. This might be of interest. The fact that I am the last surviving pianist playing the Rhapsody in Blue who played it with Paul Whiteman.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I'm not even going to ask you for the year.
Well, the first time I played it with him, I was 17. So that goes back to 1951.
And that was, well, see, that when we heard Pops, I mean, and that was always a discussion too, is Gershwin classical or is Gershwin Pops? And it was always that kind of a thing. But of course, that's all changed.
That's your perfect example of crossover.
Yes. Well, but he was really, he had this idea of incorporating jazz into a classical, you know, format, I guess. I mean, this was when Gershwin was, he was, I think he even spoke to Ravel at one point. I think he went to France and Ravel said, what do you want to be another, a mediocre Ravel when you can be a top Gershwin? You know, it was one of those. There was a tremendous change in the whole musical world when the original pop started out and then, of course, what it is now. They used to play many more classical things, popular classics, let's put it that way, on the Fiedler shows.
Yeah, but he had a format that he stayed by. And I'm not sure if they still do this, but they used to have each concert was in three parts. The first one would be straight classical. And it would, I did several concerts up there on my own. So back then, the Boston Pops was doing their thing, but there was no Cincinnati Pops. That didn't start until 1967. So they began to take the cue from Boston because it was so successful. The formula was three parts. The first one was straight classical. The second one was a guest soloist playing a movement of a concerto. Each segment would be 25 minutes, so it all depend on the time frame. And the third one would be straight popular music. So, and Fiedler was quoted as saying, that if he did that in the reverse order, the audience would leave after the first third.
Yes. Well, he was also training the audience, I think.
Yes, he was. And also, don't forget, the audiences had it in school besides those days. They had a background that they could relate to the music that was being played in the first third. And I did a concert with them in 1988. I opened up with the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony, and then we did the Romeo and Juliet overture. That was the first third. And the second third, I did my variations on I Got Rhythm, and then the Rhapsody in Blue.
Which was actually written by, wasn't that written by Gershwin, the variations? Or was
his
it
was called I Got Rhythm Variations. Mine was called Variations on I Got Rhythm. And I announced to the audience, I let them know that Gershwin had done that, and his was based on the styles of several different nationalities. And mine is based on the styles of several different so-called classical composers, such as Rachmaninoff, Prokofiev, Liszt. And then I tell them, you will also be hearing excerpts from the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata, the Wallstein Sonata, and the Handei Sonata.
Well, you're a man of many, many talents and a comedian as well.
The comment about what I just said, the reason I kid around with something like that is because the set of variations is meant to be humorous. It's meant to be satirical. It's a parody of each style that I mentioned. So
yeah.
I'm not really trying to, you know, recreate Beethoven. I'm trying to combine Beethoven with the melody of I Got Rhythm and do it in his style.
And that is particularly, as you said, that embodies the crossover mentality where you're really kind of bringing it down to the pop genre, but you're really speaking in a classical language as well, I think.
I'm also telling the people exactly what they're going to hear. I just used that line for the first time last weekend about the Hyundai. So maybe they're going to send me a new car if I say it enough. It's a nice one.
It's supposed to be maybe an electric car, too. You never know.
Oh, good. I'm saying long, but that needs a very long extension cord, doesn't it?
You can go, I think, 35 miles or something on the electric. In any case, you need a long extension cord, too, because at the rate you're going, Peter is all over the place. And I want to discuss now the it's not a new incarnation of the Pops, but it is you are not connected anymore with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Can you explain a little bit how that worked to the audience? Because it might be a little bit confusing as to what happened there.
Well, I think it was a good idea, but I don't think that the the orchestra, when I say the orchestra, I mean the players, the administration, and the board, was really ready because they had done without Pops for 104 years. I'll make that 105. The orchestra was born in 1900, and they never had a Pops series. They had some Pops concerts in there. And I think in the 60s, they flirted with the idea of a series with a Pops conductor, and it was Henry Mancini. They even made a couple of recordings that way. But, you know, to make that happen, you really have to be enthusiastic about it. It's just not enough just to get up there and say, we're going to do Pops, and that's it.
Whatever that is now, because I think that has that changed as well since you first started with the Pops?
Yeah. At the beginning, we used to do a pretty fair balance of the 50-50 with standard classical repertoire. We even did the last one with the Beethoven Ninth in our second year.
Because,
pictures and exhibition.
Yeah. In other words, something that is well known, in the old days, it was well known and often heard classical music, maybe of a shorter length or something. But it changed over the years because it really incorporated music that was not classical. I don't want to say it was jazz or anything. It was just not classical music. And that's, I think, what the difference is.
Well, that's the first thing to go in the schools is music.
Of course.
With the budget cuts. And I had some interesting experiences because one of the years, early years in the 80s, early years of the Philly Pops, I did the first and last movement of the Ponchielli Dance of the Hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to the audience, you've all heard of the Ponchielli Dance of the Hours, haven't you? And I'd get pretty much a blank stare coming back at me. But when I said to them, you really know this music because the first movement was taken by Alan Sherman and made into Hello Mudda, Hello Father. And the last movement is currently being used as the theme for the commercial for Aquafresh toothpaste. So everybody said, oh, I know. See, this way, they're already familiar with it. They know they've heard it. And we had a lot of help from commercials and from film.
And the attitude changed. You see, they wasn't as, I don't want to say stuffy, but, you know, it was very serious when you went into a concert hall. I mean, that's what it was. And you listened to music a certain way, and you weren't really... You weren't even allowed to deviate from that. I think that this was, as everything moves on in life, especially in the arts, it expands and it becomes more open in a sense. It's a different way of thinking, I believe, because you've got to incorporate this in what happens in civilization. I mean, you evolve. Isn't that really what happens? Hopefully.
Well, I think what has happened is that orchestras throughout the country have come to realize now that there is an audience out there, and that audience has to be pleased. And if they're not pleased, they're not going to come back. And you cannot count on donations, contributions, and foundations the rest of your existence. You really have to think about who's sitting out there. Now, I saw Harrison Ford as a guest on Letterman one night, and he was shooting a picture in New York. So Letterman asked him and said to him, I understand you like to leave your hotel very often and walk around the city and window shop. And he said, do people come up and talk to you? And he said, of course they do. And he said, well, he said, does that bother you at all? Is that, you know, that your privacy is kind of invaded? And he said, not at all. I talk to them. He said, because they're my customers. Mm-hmm. And I never heard an artist, a performer of any kind, refer to their fans as customers. And I thought, that's what a great way of putting it, because that's who my boss is. It's the audience. If they don't like what we're doing, I got to do something about it.
But you also introduce things to your customers. I mean, you have new styles.
That's a bait and switch is what it is. You give them what they really crave, and then you give them something that you think they're going to like. And you've meanwhile gotten their trust for a number of reasons. One, you are taking them into consideration and selecting the repertoire. Two, you have an orchestra that is very energetic, and their lives depend on what they play and how they play it. So they really, there's two things in our favor right there. And the third one is it's just a question of balance. How much do you give them that's right up the middle, and how much do you give them that's a little bit off center?
So now, again, you are, well, you're still the Philly Pops, Peter Nero and the Philly Pops, but you are an entity unto yourself, is that right?
Yes, and we always were when we were within the Philly Orchestra. We were never a part of them. We were, like, in the sense that we were absorbed into them. We always had our own operation operating within. That began to shrink as finances got bad for the Philadelphia Orchestra. So our staff was reduced, and we were sharing administrative services, I think the way they put it. In terms of it was never a merger. That was a no word. Don't ask me why, but that's mm-hmm. the way it was.
So now you are, I mean, what is different now? Let's put it that way.
Well, right now we're in a transitory stage. So that is tricky because we really have to move on our own. And that's what we did before we came in. But it takes time. We had 6 people on staff. And now we have 2. Now we've just added a third.
Well, yes, but I'm talking about the orchestra. I mean, you're still doing the same thing, aren't you?
You mean the same thing we were doing before?
Yeah.
In terms of?
Music.
You mean repertoire?
Repertoire. Well, I mean even playing, giving the same kind of concerts that you were giving before.
Well, we try and change with the times.
But I mean, what I'm saying is people suddenly said, well, wait a minute, what happened? What happened?
We're still here. That's what happened.
I think that's what's very important. You're still here. You're still doing, you still have your audience that loves you and loves the things that you do. You're still performing the type of concerts that they love, no?
Yeah. I always take what they want into consideration. We're doing our holiday concerts. Normally we have an October series, and we had to kill that because the debate went on so long that it was just too late to start in October. So actually, the full season, the subscription season, is going to start February. February, March, April, May. And we will have our single ticket sale series, which is 7 concerts of holiday concerts. Now we have the Pops Festival Chorus, which is a group of professional musicians, but they act all as volunteers. And it's amazing how many of them come and sign up every year. Especially this year when we were so late in putting it together. So we have our 140 up there. That takes up a large part of the coral loft, if not all of it.
Yes, it's very impressive, too, when you see that.
Yeah, well, if you buy music by the pound, we win. So aside from that, we also have the African Episcopal Church St.
Yes.
Thomas Gospel
mm-hmm.
Choir. And
yes.
they're anywhere from 40 to 60 voices, as many as we can fit into that loft. And then below the loft, on the floor, we have half of the Philadelphia Boys Choir. Now, they're usually 90, but there's not enough room. Plus the fact that they're little boys. So the idea of having them work every day and every night, it's good to stagger it. So we actually have two groups that perform.
So in other words, now, anyone who has been used to going to hear the Philly Pops, well, certainly for the Christmas season, but I mean, generally you have these series, nothing's really changed. You're still there. They can still get tickets. They can still keep up the tradition that they've been doing for years and years and years. Right?
I hope so. So far, everything is coming in way ahead of schedule. So we're very happy about that.
Now, again, you have how many series for the year?
This year, we're going to have four series plus the holiday concerts. Last year, we had five because we had one in October. We couldn't do it this year because we were still negotiating.
I also want to talk to you about the fact that you have been doing appearances elsewhere on your own with other orchestras. And tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you've just come back from Kansas City, is that right?
That's right. Did a concert in Kansas City that was a jazz concert. It was on a jazz series at a theater there that's 125 years old. And they're trying to preserve it. At the same time this season, a new complex, a $450 million complex, opened there in Kansas City, just like we have here. It's like the Kimmel, with a large auditorium and a smaller auditorium. And that is, for the big shows. But this theater holds 1,100 people, and it's really steeped in some very interesting history. It's also can't be touched because the building is a national treasure, and it's called the Folly Theater. The reason they call it the Folly Theater is because it originally started as a burlesque house in the days when burlesque meant comedians.
Mm.
And the jokes were, as they described in the brochure, blue. And it went from that to strippers,
mm-hmm.
including I saw the posters on the wall that, under the theater that they had from way back in the 1900s, early 1900s, Gypsy Rose Lee.
I was going to say Gypsy Rose Lee.
Tempest Storm.
Yes.
Blaze Star. Notice how I remember all these
names.
Well,
you remember those. Those are not from the early part of the. That's somewhere, yes. Well, I think what age were you probably?
I was about 2 years old at the time, yeah.
No, but it's very interesting. What I think people should know that, I mean, Peter Nero in his own right is such a marvelous performer, an arranger, a conductor, but essentially a pianist and a classical and jazz artist. And you are making appearances. People have requested that you come and perform with their local, say, Pops orchestra. So I just wanted to tell the audience a little about where you've been this year so far.
This year, frankly, I've been in court most of the time, so I haven't had time to do anything else but fight. And I can't tell you that we won, but we're still around, so that's what really counts, and that's what I was looking for, was for us to be what we were before we came in.
I guess what I want to say here is I admire my guest today here on Crossover. He's an extremely talented man. We're very fortunate to have him here in Philadelphia. He is now a musical director for many, many years. And I guess what you're going through, too, is trying to share all of this with your listening public. And aren't we lucky? That's really the upshot of it all. And we hope that you will continue, striving for what you believe you want to give to the public. And you got to keep playing that piano.
I'm humbled by by what you have just said. So I really appreciate that. That's very kind of you.
Well, it's true. So it's easy.